Trish Wood on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to TNT Radio, everybody. This is your host, Owen Stevens, filling in for Trish Wood. Thank you for tuning in, everybody. That means a lot. See, you listening to this show really shows that we can use the internet for good reasons. We can use the internet to better people's lives. We can use the internet to spread truth and righteousness. And that is something that I think Christians are just understanding. We're just understanding that. We're just grasping that. The left has been doing that for years, and they understand, and they really have a strong, you know, stranglehold on the internet right now. But it is up to us to make sure that we bring you truth, liberty, and American values presently and often. Thank you for tuning in. Everybody, I am joined by a very special guest. William Kay is a very skilled radio speaker and adept at discussing legal matters and fakery and the science behind man-made global warming. A terrific, he attended a BA English in 1982 and a law degree in 1985. After briefly practicing law, he went on to establish small businesses and nonprofits. He's written the books, the number one, The Green Swastika Environmentalism in the Third Reich, and From Matthias to Mithperstone, a primer on the population control movement, which is really what I want to talk about today. William Kay, how are you doing today?
I'm doing very well. Beautiful day here in Saskatchewan.
Yeah, it's an okay day here right now. I'm in Grand Rapids, Michigan, so a little, you know, south of you. We got, you know, cloudy skies.
Not too far away. We're in the center of the continent here.
Right, yeah, that's not too bad at all.
In
so I want to talk about right now your views on this population control movement. That's one of the most interesting things I think that you have written about. Can you kind of give me like a brief explanation as to what your thesis outlines as in regards to the population control movement?
Well, it's a topic I've been researching for decades. I'm 62 now. I thought I would write a book about that. I wrote it about 3 or 4 years ago. Basically, the history of the movement was that, starting with Malthus in 1795, he and his sort of ilk were outraged by the emergence of actual welfare programs. And they feared that if the government started doing that, the laboring population would sort of breed themselves into a huge number of people, and there would be this official pauperism. So it has its origins in that. And they started to, you know, he was quite explicit that, you know, the poor should starve to death. And he was also quite explicit that the housing conditions of the poor should be as horrible as possible. The government should do what they could, and just through benign neglect, to make the living standards of these people horrible so that their lives would be short and with as few children as possible.
Right.
By the end of his life, he also, and this ties into sort of where I think we might have some common ground, by the end of his life, he also started alluding to ideas that the government might want to promote other forms of sexuality which would not lead to as many children. Of course, he was an ordained Anglican minister. He couldn't get into the nitty-gritty of what he was talking about. But the subsequent generations of the Malthusians, and this is a mass movement. It is one of the largest social movements in the world today. It's gone through several different incarnations. But it remains the population control movement, which grew out of Malthus and his followers. You know, just the UN Population Fund alone has a budget of $1.3 billion. A lot of these groups have budgets in the tens of millions. So the enormous social movement emerged out of that. And just, I got to explain something to the non-sociologists out there. Allow me.
Of course.
There are social movements, and there are built constituencies, and there are industrial complexes. And these are the dinosaurs that stalk the swamp in which we all run around like little marsupials. Social
right.
movements modify governments, they change the regulatory environment, and this leads to various business enterprises emerging. Prime example is the wind power industry. You know, it starts late 1980s, early 1990s, the climate change campaign begins. At that time, wind power was completely uneconomical. Nobody took it seriously. The largest wind terminals, they measured them in kilovolts, not even megawatts, right? They were small. Then due to the political pressure of a social movement, the climate movement, the environmental movement, a lot of governments started changing the regulations, requiring electric grid operators to buy this electricity at exorbitant rates. They got governments to fund research and development. They got governments to actually fund for the payment of the actual wind turbines themselves. So over the course of the last 30 years, the wind power industry has developed. There is no way it would have developed by market forces alone. But now we've got this enormous industry, wind power, and there's giant multinationals like Siemens Energy and General Electric are deeply involved in this. The overall wind industry probably employs 500,000 people. So it has become a powerful lobby in its own right. It is now an industrial operation. It's part of the climate industrial complex, along with solar power, electrical vehicles. But the industrial complex itself has got tremendous economic momentum. And a lot of the people who are involved in things like wind power are now funding the climate campaign. So you see how a social movement can cause regulatory and economic and legal changes that can give rise to giant industries. Those industries themselves become too big to fail. And similar things have happened with the population control movement. As I point out in the book, you know, America right now, close to 1,700 abortion clinics. This was entirely ridiculous. The result of the population control movement. The international contraceptive industry has gross sales of over $25 billion. And there's a lot of big businesses and small businesses involved in these industries. But but for the activities of the population control movement, those industries would not have existed at all. It was entirely an initiative of the population controllers that abortion became legalized and normalized, what have you. This was... No pun intended, this was their baby. But you can see how once the abortion industry is in place, there's probably, 50,000 Americans who work in abortion clinics.
And I mean, that's so interesting.
Go ahead.
Yeah, well, Margaret Sanger, in the founding of Planned Parenthood is one of the things that really always troubled me from very early on, understanding that she was a eugenicist, that these people created Planned Parenthood with the specific goal in mind of killing children. That we see this right now when when Roe v. Wade was overturned and the government is no longer the arbiter of life in our country, rather the states can decide. We see Planned Parenthood's closing down, but for years, Planned Parenthood has told us that, we do much more than provide abortions. Abortion is not a center of our business. It's contraception. It's other, it's healthcare. It's reproductive healthcare, reproductive rights. Abortion is not the center of what we do. But as soon as abortion is made, as soon as Roe v. Wade is overturned and left up to the states to decide, and as soon as states decide to regulate abortion, we see Planned Parenthood conveniently closing its doors. The reason for that simply is because that is the business. There is a big business that revolves around killing and selling the children that are aborted at these clinics, which is it's such a troubling thing. And to bring in even a bigger aspect of the population control movement, what you address was the LGBTQ movement that I see right now in my generation. We're 40 years apart, William. I'm 22. You're 62. My generation, Generation Z. In 2015, 10% of my generation identified, which is a word I hate using. I hate that word, identified, because everybody has to identify with something now. But 10% of my Generation Z identified as LGBTQ, LGBTQIA+, $1, $2, $3, whatever you want to say. And then 5 years later, 5 years later in 2020, it was up to 22.5% of Generation Z identified as LGBTQ. We see this in the education system. We see it perpetuated. It's like an indoctrination camp that these kids are going to. Yeah. And they're learning how to be gay. They're learning to, fall into this trap of this LGBTQ lobby. What do you think that is going to do as far as the population is concerned when 22% of my generation are going to be unable to biologically produce kids because they're either gay, lesbian, or they're transgender and getting their parts removed?
Mm-hmm. Well, this is part of the plan. The population control movement has been promoting homosexuality. Like I say, Malthus mentions it like in 1833. Fast forward about 100 years, there's a group called the World Sex Liberation Council. Wow. It meets in Europe. 1,000 leading academics are part of it. And they, you know, they were A, population control fanatics. They advocated a number of things. One, forced sterilization of the poor, forced sterilization of anybody who had exhibited uncontrolled fertility, and the normalization and legalization of homosexuality. You know, they were all for abortion and things like that. Promoting homosexuality is just another tool in their toolkit. In my book, right, I go to, you know, the late 50s, 1960s, and I pull up several quotes from leading figures from the Ford Foundation and from the Princeton, the Office of Population Studies, et cetera. And there's one famous one called the Jaffe Memo. And they were discussing various ways in which they can put a brake on fertility of the American population, particularly of the American labor force. And they explicitly say, you know, promoting homosexuality would be one way to do it. Incidentally, they also said make daycare really expensive as a way to sort of discourage people from having right. kids. But this is something they've been grinding away at for a long time. You can find, you know, very explicit statements from people who are pro-abortion, pro-sterilization, pro-population control, advocating for homosexuality over 100 years ago. And this sort of comes to a head in the late 1960s. During the Johnson administration, there were some real overpopulation hawks that effectively captured the American government. And that's when you see abortion getting legalized. And that's when you see sort of the outbreak of the sort of the gay liberation movement. And it definitely is a propaganda campaign. It's coming through the mass media. It's coming through the educational institutions. And it betrays this notion that somehow people are born gay. You know, you're pointing to stats right. for your generation having these high figures. The overall stats for the United States are 3.5% of the population are identifying as LGB. But you're right, in your generation it's much higher because they're younger and they have been subjected to this propaganda from a much earlier level and from their real authority figures, their schools and what have you. And there's agencies that do nothing but distribute this sort of literature to schools. We have these drag queen story hours for little kids in public libraries and what have you. They're really promoting this to them. And at the end of the day, what you're going to have is a lot fewer kids.
And I think you're right about that. And that's what we're seeing right now. Look at the birth.
These fanatical. Go ahead.
Yeah, the birth replacement rates right now are falling off. You look at China, their birth replacement rate. I talked about this literally on the last segment I just did about how the fear for so long with these, you know, this population control, this movement was that we're going to reach 9 billion people. We're going to reach 10 billion people. How are we going to sustain all of these people? But what we see is that birth rates, they're not even high enough to replacement rate right now. We don't have a replacement rate as far as our birth rate going, which means that more people are dying than are being born. So it's not really that a population boom is the issue. Rather, I think it's a population decline that is going to end up being the bigger issue. What do you think about that?
I put me on record as saying this planet is nowhere near overpopulated. You could put a zero, at least one zero after the current population. We could easily sustain much larger populations than this. This is a big empty planet. You know, I wrote an article that appeared in one of the science zines out there about the Amazon. It's size of Europe. Nobody lives there on the equator, and it's the wettest place on Earth. One of my email pals is a guy from Texas who bought some agricultural properties there, and the government, the environmentalists, trying to shut him down. But the agricultural potential of the Amazon is more than enough to feed the whole planet sometimes over. You go to the United States, half of the land west of Chicago is owned by the federal government. It's taken out of production. Groups like some of these big conservation agencies have taken enormous amounts of land out of production. Ducks Unlimited is one of the worst because the land that they are taking out of production is this marshland and sloughs, which could easily be turned into very productive farmland. The amount of farmland taken out of production by Ducks Unlimited alone is greater than the whole farmland on the British Isles. And that's a very agriculturally productive place. So in terms of increasing agricultural product, there's a huge amount of empty land there. If we got serious about irrigation, you know, the Western United States could be the breadbasket of the world. And there were a lot of plans until the environmental movement became the powerhouse that they are, to, you know, really develop more irrigation facilities in the North American, the western half of the North American continent, but those have all been shelved. So in terms of agricultural product, you know, we have nothing to worry about. We're nowhere near any sort of overpopulation problem. You know, you could take
entire
population of Canada would fit into Tokyo, Yokohama.
Wow.
And the rest
that,
of
I mean,
Canada
that's a great point. I think that that absolutely... That spits in the face of the lie that this is, you know, the climate alarmist lie that we're going to die in like 12 years. You have people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez saying literally that we are going to be at, you know, there's going to be like a kind of like this Apocalypse Now situation where everybody is going to die in 12 years and that we have to do something about it. Just do something. Just do something. These buzzwords that they're using. Everybody, we are going to go to break and then discuss more of this with William Kay, who is amazing, right after the break.
TNT Radio's Hervoy Morich.
It's being reported that beef prices are poised for a surge that could last years. So years and years without those tasty hamburgers. Beef prices are surging because of severe droughts across the western U.S., forcing mass cattle slaughters, or as I mentioned in Ireland, they're paying farmers 5,000 euros to slaughter their hamburgers. I mean, cows and meat distributors say the natural disaster could keep supplies tight for years. Really feeds well into Bill Gates's synthetic meat plan and insect bug burger plan.
Hervoy Morich on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
I will be right by your side.
Women can have it all, including heart attacks. But symptoms like jaw pain, nausea, unusual fatigue, dizziness, and backache are often different and more subtle than for a man. The fact is, heart disease is the number one killer of women. Know the signs. Learn more at GetHeartChecked.org from Women's Heart Alliance in partnership with Women Heart.
The bushfire was so unpredictable. It was important to have a plan.
We stayed up to date with our phones and the radio. We knew it was coming.
I never thought it would actually happen. I'm glad we had a plan.
You have to prepare your property and your family.
Always had a plan.
We can all be bushfire ready. Do your 5-minute bushfire plan today.
News and talk you can't hear anywhere else.
It gives you some awareness of what's really going on.
Where things are at, even around the world.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to the Trish Wood Show. This is Owen Stevens filling in for Trish Wood. Thank you for tuning in, everybody. Again, we are so grateful for your ears and the time that you are giving us to deliver these messages that need to get out. It's so important that we stand up for truth, liberty, and American values that have benefited human society more than anything has. Trust in God, faith in what His plan is, and the Holy Spirit, and trusting on Jesus alone is the most important thing that we can possibly do. And that is, you know, that's my, I think in everything that I do, that's probably the main point I could ever get across, which is that it's so important that we trust in Jesus. And it's like we're walking on a high wire right now. There's so many anxieties that are, you know, to our left and to our right, and we don't know which way to turn. And it's very difficult to keep your eyes focused on Jesus and on Christ. And what I want to talk about with William, real quick, William, now, one of the things that this transgender movement has done is they've repackaged, and you talked a lot about sterilization. And what I think this transgender movement has done is repackage sterilization as gender-affirming care. One of the things that, this is a story that just came out, I want to get your opinion about this. The Boston Children's Hospital just touted gender-affirming hysterectomies. They said that gender-affirming hysterectomies that they're providing gender-affirming hysterectomies, which means they're essentially, from little kids, removing their parts if they identify as a gender other than the one assigned at birth. Is this sterilization that is just being accepted widely by our culture right now?
Yes, there is mass sterilization going on in the United States and in every other modern Western world. The sterilization program really got going in the 1950s, in Puerto Rico. It was a program initiated by the Rockefeller family. And what they mastered was the postpartum consent. They realized that if you ask the right questions to a woman immediately after she's had birth, as she's gone through the trauma of having birth, she will consent to sterilization. And in the course of one decade, not exaggerating, they sterilized one third of all the women in Puerto Rico. And the men who were doing this were explicitly racist. They hated Puerto Rican people. But to this day in the United States, anybody going into a Planned Parenthood clinic for an abortion gets a high-pressure sales pitch for sterilization. I think there's around slightly less than a million sterilizations being done every year in the United States. I'll tell you a few just anecdotes from my own personal life. Very good friend of mine, a woman, she went in for a cyst removal down there. Her doctor gave her this high-pressure pitch, you know, we're going to do this operation, you might as well have a hysterectomy while you're doing it. She said no. The day of the surgery, he comes back, like hours before the surgery, gives her the high-pressure sales pitch again, and she agrees to it, and she regrets it to this day. She told this to a friend of hers.
Wow.
The friend had the same story. She wanted to get a cyst removed. The doctor said, they gave her this pitch about, you know, you might as well, you know, get sterilized while we're doing it. She said no. Mm-hmm. A day or two before the surgery, the doctor calls her in, gives her the spiel again for the sterilization. She said no again. And then the doctor said, well, then find yourself another doctor.
Oh,
so there's
my
all
gosh.
Kinds of high-pressure sales pitches going on there to get women sterilized. These doctors must make a little mark on the wall every time they do it. But what they found really effective, I even read a paper about this in one of these population control journals, getting women to consent to sterilization during emergency cesarean section. Like she's on the table, she's going through emergency cesarean section, and you get her to consent at that moment to sterilization.
Right.
And that is how they get these vast numbers of sterilization. But there's, I call it the abortion, contraception, sterilization industrial complex. And it employs a lot of people. And there's a lot of, particularly gynecologists, seem to get into the business because they are population control fanatics. I profile several of them in the book, people who were gynecologists, but they were also people who burn the midnight oil, you know, going to population control meetings and advocating new and novel ways to engage in population control. But they're great believers in sterilizations. The Nazis were great believers in sterilization. They sterilized millions of people. They sterilized people for having moral failings. They sterilized people for, you know, being alcoholics or what have you. They had all kinds of lists. These people get sterilized. The American eugenics movement, back when they called themselves the eugenics movement, they had this list of people who they determined, you know, must be sterilized, and it was quite a long list of types of people. So yeah, exactly. This transgendered thing is a sterilization campaign. All of these people,
I think it absolutely
going
is
through these transgendered operations. One thing's for sure: at the end of the day, they are going to be infertile. Just want to plug a documentary that was made in Canada. It's called Whose Decision Is It? It was banned in Canada. It was very professionally done. It was banned in the UK. And it's about these parents who decide for their children that they're going to be transgendered. And it's an absolute crime what's happening. And it's the old joke, you know,
when
someone says their cat is a vegan, we know whose decision it really was. And they just they take you through some of these families, and they show what's going on, and clearly the parents are making the decision for the kid. Like some idiotic parent who's trying to be hip or has got whatever other trip they're on, have decided that they're going to give their 14-year-old hormone blockers and set them on a path of being some other type of gender. And it's just horrific. And they interview a few people who went through this, and their lives are ruined. They're 20
ruined,
years old,
yes.
And they just completely regret having done it. And now they've been just mutilated.
Well, they're victims.
By these
they're victims of this culture. Yeah, well, they're victims of this culture that has told them that they must change genders in order to combat these feelings that they're feeling. Instead of going to therapy, instead of trusting in your family, instead of doing things that are tried and true, proven things to help you combat, you know, we know these people that are susceptible to these surgeries struggle a great deal with depression and anxiety, these feelings of hopelessness. These are things that you need to combat a different way, but what these ideologues are telling them is that the only way that you can get past this is by going in and removing all of your body parts, becoming deprived of the ability to have proper and true sex, and then live your life that way. Live your life as a woman and you'll magically be happy. But what we see is that the suicide rates are just the same. The suicide rates after a gender-affirming surgery are around 39%, which is exactly what they are before gender-performing surgery. And what we're seeing is a giant amount of people who are absolutely unhappy with what has been done to them. They realize that now they're living their life as sort of this Frankenstein that's been pulled apart on this table by these doctors who do not have their best interest at heart. But you know what they do see? They see a dollar sign on every patient, every transgender patient, every person that's struggling with that they want to push that gender-affirming care. They see a giant dollar sign right on that patient. So, William K., thank you very much for coming on the show. I'm so thrilled to have spoken to you. I know that we're going to be speaking together more on TNT. Thank you for coming in. Thank you for giving your perspective. It's incredibly valuable. I'm going to give you like a couple seconds to plug what you're doing next. Thank you so much.
I'll tell you what, I'm not a religious guy, but I've got a biblical quote for you. Jonah,
I love it.
Chapter 4, verse 11. Okay? It's about the people who did not know left from right. And that's my sort of critique of Turning Point USA. What you are calling the left is actually the neo-fascist movement. It isn't really the left at all. You're actually complimenting them. They want to appear left. But these guys are...
they're not. Yeah, they're not liberal.
The other side of the spectrum and then some. Jonah, 4:11.
Okay, I love that verse. I think that's absolutely right. I think that's the difference between liberal and leftist. I always make that distinction between the difference between what a liberal is and liberalism and leftism, which I think is deteriorating.
Neo-fascism has a history of trying to masquerade as a left-wing movement.
Right.
These people are not leftists at all. They're elitists who have a very hostile attitude towards the working population in general.
Yeah. I absolutely agree. It's really the battle for, it's a battle against the globalists. It's the patriots, the individualists against the globalists. Thank you, William K., for coming on. I will see you next time we do a show. I appreciate it very much. Next, we have a quick, we're going to do a quick switch right here. My next guest is Ronnie Cummins. Very excited to talk to Ronnie Cummins. He is the founder of OCA and an outspoken critic of mad science and the COVID-19 response that was perpetuated on us by this tyrannical government that we're living under. Really, just this regime, I think that's appropriate to call it right now, is a regime. This Biden administration, what they've done in response to COVID, this vaccine culture, this religion around the vaccine and about masking, it's like a cult. And this mass formation, that psychosis that has taken hold of America to make them afraid, fearful, and in utter chaos and depravity. I want to talk about that with Ronnie. And I'll talk really quickly about some of the work he's done real quick. He is the founder of OCA. And of course, he writes this. One of the things that I think is really interesting that he has written, this is an article that he wrote about OCA. He wrote, and of course, the best way to achieve this desired state, which is that state I was talking about, that deprived state where COVID-19 is essentially this fear tactic that has been used against us. But there's so many things that play into this and this culture that these globalists want to create. One of the things that OCA, which is basically advocating for organic food, has, this is one of the things he's written. Ronnie wrote, and of course, the best way to achieve this desired state is to grow, cook, and consume an organic and regenerative diet of fresh whole foods, everybody, and grass-fed or pastured meat and animal products, if you're a carnivore. In turn, this organic diet needs to be complemented by regular exercise, fresh air, sunshine, adequate sleep, positive thoughts, and natural herbs and dietary supplements, using the earth to our advantage. That's one of the things that OCA is advocating for. It's so important that we do that, that we understand what the earth can provide us. We've been given an amazing blessing as humans. As humans, not only have, I'll relate COVID right now to food and how this all ties in is, as humans, we were given a God-given immune system. God gave us an immune system. And when he created us in the beginning, he said, we were good. He looked at what he had created and he said, it is good. If God says that it is good after he has created you, then you must think that that doesn't have to be much improvement. It's already good. He made us with an immune system. He made us with the ability to combat disease in real time. So it's really, really, important that we understand that we are blessed with an immune system, that we don't need man-made and manufactured vaccines to be injected into our body to somehow make up for our lack of defense when we were born with that defense in the first place. God gave us the ability to recover. He gave us the ability to grow and get stronger. That is one of the things that he has blessed us with. Similarly, with the food and the plant life that is around and the ability to grow food yourself. My mom, for instance, grows food in a garden organically. We eat the vegetables from the soil in our backyard. That's a blessing. That's one of the things that we were blessed with, the ability to do that ourselves, to cultivate the land ourselves, which is exactly what the globalists do not want us to do. Ronnie, are you on the line yet? I want to ask you about this article that you wrote.
Yes, I am here.
Great. It is great to meet you. And I want to talk about right now the, if you could give a little introduction into OCA, which is Organic Consumers Association, what exactly it is, what exactly your mission is, and where people can go to find you.
Yes. Organic Consumers Association has been around about 25 years, and we're a nationwide network in the United States of approximately 2 million organic consumers. And we've been dedicated from the beginning to exposing the problems of chemical-intensive, energy-intensive GMO agriculture and promoting the natural alternative, organic food farming, land use. We started up because the organic community had grown and grown, but we didn't have a nationwide organization to represent our interests. And we've grown over the years, and we're now part of an international network of organizations, including Regeneration International, the president of whom is actually an Australian organic farmer, Andre Lowe.
Yeah, that's very, very interesting. In this article I want to read right now, you talk about the importance of, you know, basically a holistic diet. One of the things that I've noticed a lot about these globalists and about, you know, this new ageism that's coming down, cracking down on the food industry, really what is a food revolution, this war on farmers, this, you know, Justin Trudeau, what he's doing in Canada, he's limiting people's access to fertilizer. We see the same thing done in Sri Lanka. It's ruining the soil. It's ruining people's ability to produce food themselves. And in that way, they're very much reliant on the global production of food and about these, you know, the distribution of food from the government. And they're relying not on themselves, but on the state. They're relying on other people to do it for them. What does OCA do to address how important it is to grow food yourself, to make sure that you're self-sufficient?
Yes, well, I think it became evident a little bit before I was born in the Second World War that everyday people could grow the majority of the food that they eat in their backyards and parks, community gardens. In the U.S., we call them victory gardens, and we were producing over 40% of the fruits and vegetables that we consumed during the Second World War. And in the U.K., I think the figure is around 30%. And in today's world, even though you never hear anything about it, the Russian people don't have that much faith in their government, so they still produce about half their food in their gardens, their dakas, outside of urban areas. They produce about 50% of all the vegetables and herbs and fruits that they eat. So we can produce a heck of a lot of food in our urban areas and our suburban areas, even though you know, they constitute a small percentage of the total land mass in our countries. We've always done this.
Right.
And I think the current food crisis and just the deterioration of the quality and the contamination of so-called conventional food has convinced most of us, like myself. I'm a manager of two organic farms, one up here in northern Minnesota during the summer and one the rest of the year in north central Mexico. It's really important that we reconnect with what was normal for our grandparents and great grandparents and start producing some of our own food, even if it's in the windowsill producing germinating sunflower seeds, or you know, potted tomatoes on your back porch. We can do it, and it's good for us mentally, physically. And if the food you can't produce, you can buy it from local and regional producers, and look for stuff that's truly natural, that's organic. And if it's a animal meat or animal feed, look for stuff where the animals were raised naturally on pasture. And if they're herbivores, where they ate grass instead of GMO soybeans and corn.
Right. Well, that's an amazing point. I think that that's one of the craziest things right now is that, you know, big food in this industry around, you know, that the lie is that you can't produce your own food yourself. That's the lie. The lie is that it's too hard. It takes too much time. It's you know, it's not sustainable. It's not beneficial. So you have to rely on us. And that is the culture that I think we need to battle against the most right now, especially because we're in a state where we're going to be losing a lot of our supply when it comes to food. We're witnessing a food crisis right now. Groceries, you know, are in short supply. People do not have food on the shelves to go buy at the store. And what we're realizing is that if we're dependent on this national structure to provide us with food and then they fail, then we're really in a bad situation. And if we don't know what we're doing, if we do not develop the skills, if we do not develop the appropriate know-how on how to till the land ourselves, on how to achieve sustainability and food production in our own backyards, then we're going to really be in a difficult situation when the food is not there at the grocery store. Everybody, we're going to go to break, and we're going to continue to discuss with Ronnie after the break. Everybody, thank you for tuning in. We'll see you really soon.
We're saved. A professor has found the root cause of climate change. And you guessed it, white supremacy. This is Mark Morano for the Morano Minute on TNT Radio. Stay tuned.
From Washington, D.C., this is the Morano Minute with your host, TNT Radio's Mark Morano.
Dr. Jacqueline Gill of the University of Maine has now claimed that, quote, the root causes of climate change are capitalism, white supremacy, colonialism. Gill is an associate professor of paleoecology and plant ecology at the University of Maine. If Dr. Gill is correct, the only solution is for the whole world to go Marxist. Yes, that's right. Give up your freedoms, your rights, and listen to the centrally planned economy. But here's the catch. Even if we give up all our freedoms to fight the alleged climate crisis, the weather and climate will not notice. This professor joins two NASA scientists in claiming the same thing, that white supremacy is a driver of climate change. Yes, all a day's work in the wacky world of climate. For the Morano Minute, this is Mark Morano on TNT Radio.
When you're high, you feel different. You think different, you talk different, you draw different, you listen to music different, but you probably knew that. Problem is, you also drive different, and not in a good way. That's why driving high is illegal everywhere. So if you're high, just don't drive. Make a plan to get a sober ride. Because if you feel different, you drive different. Brought to you by NHTSA and the Ad Council.
Children in poverty. Each one unique, each one full of dreams. They're our hope, our future. They're the reason Children International exists. When the whole world changed, we developed new ways to reach children and families in poverty during these vulnerable times.
I'm learning every day.
I'm healthy and strong.
To learn more, go to children.org/help today.
Mainstream media censors, smears, and intimidates those telling the truth. We mandate that the truth be told. Today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome back to the Trish Wood Show. I am Owen Stevens, filling in for Trish Wood. Thank you for tuning in again. Back with Ronnie. Ronnie, I consider you, as a farmer managing two huge organic farms, I consider you an agriculture expert. So I want to get your opinion on this. I'm going to read you something. This is what the World Economic Forum, what these globalists are trying to push down our throats, this reliance on insects now, because they're so afraid of meat. They're so afraid of red meat. They're so afraid of the traditional way that we, you know, eat meat and grow meat, that they're trying to introduce insects as a viable food option. They say this: edible insects contain high quality protein, vitamins, and amino acids for humans. Insects have a high food conversion rate, Crickets need 6 times less feed than cattle, 4 times less than sheep, and twice as less than pigs and broiler chickens to produce the same amount of protein. Besides, they emit less greenhouse gases and ammonia that conventional livestock emit. Insects can be grown on organic waste. Therefore, insects are a potential source for conventional production for food, either for direct human consumption or indirectly in recomposed foods with extracted protein from insects and as a protein source in feedstock mixtures. What do you think about eating insects? When are you going to start eating bugs?
Well, I already do eat some down in Mexico. The grasshoppers, the chapulines, are, they come out this time of year. You catch them so they don't eat up your plants, and you can roast some of them as if you're drinking a little mezcal after dinner, you eat some of those. But, Mexican people and people in general in rural areas know that it's ridiculous to talk about replacing meat and animal products with insects. I mean, there are 1 billion people on the planet whose main livelihood are their livestock and their animals. And if you say that we've got to get rid of animal agriculture and have genetically engineered lab meat and animal products and eating bugs as a substitute, no one believes you in rural areas who has anything to do with farming. And, nutritionists and health experts point out that, humans grew up as carnivores. You don't have to be a carnivore to be healthy, but most people who try to not be carnivores, if they go to the extremes, it impairs their health. So eating a reasonable amount of grass-fed or pastured meat and animal products is not only not bad for your health, it's very good for your health. And I'm proud to break the law in the United States this morning and every morning by consuming raw milk, raw organic milk that the conventional dairy industry and the great resetters say should be stamped out. That's ridiculous. I learned from my grandparents in Southeast Texas who were organic farmers, even though they didn't use the word organic. They were just farming like their parents and grandparents had always farmed. But I learned right away that you don't need chemical fertilizer. You don't need pesticides. You don't need to pin up your animals in a cruel manner in order to produce really healthy food. And you don't need the government intervention, because farmers are quite capable of talking to one another and sharing best practices, exchanging food, exchanging the stuff that we need. And this great reset, as envisioned by Bill Gates and Vanguard and, BlackRock, all these idiots, when you look at what they fund genetically engineered seeds. They fund chemical intensive fossil fuel inputs that are extremely expensive, that don't work as well as natural organic things. And now they're telling us, hey, we're going to get rid of all meat. We'll just do fermentation and genetic engineering in these laboratories, and we'll slap on your plate stuff that bleeds and looks like meat and kind of tastes like meat, but it's patented. We own it and we control it, and you're going to eat this whether you like it or not.
I mean, that's the collectivization of food, which is a huge issue. One of the things that I think this is going back to Soviet era history in 1932 and 1933. One of the things that Stalin tried to do was collectivize the food in the Soviet Union. He realized that the cities didn't have enough food to meet people's daily requirements. People were dying of starvation in the city, so he needed to find a way out of this. So what he did is he went to the wealthy landowners that were called kulaks in Russia, and he said, this land is no longer yours. I understand that you know what you're doing, and these were expert farmers that knew how to grow crops. They knew how to manage farms. They were experts at what they did. But the government came down and said, nope, no longer. This is our land now. You don't own it. And we're going to ship you off to a gulag to work and then die while we own it and centrally plan it. The people that came down from the Soviet government to centrally plan those farms did not know what they were doing. They had no idea what they're doing. And it resulted in the starvation of 6 million Ukrainians in 1933 as a result of that de-kulakization that Stalin had done. And that was a direct result of the collectivization of agriculture. One of the things that we're seeing play out in real time, where because of climate change, they don't want us to be self-reliant. One of the things that my mom did really early was she got chickens. And she said, it's relatively easy to grow chickens. It's a lot of work. There's a lot of time and work that goes into keeping them properly. But chickens can provide you with enormous resources, eggs. They can provide you with meat and it very sustainably. They also take care of insects. One of the things that I don't want to do is on Super Bowl Sunday, instead of pizza and chicken wings, I don't want to have a beetle. I don't want to eat pizza and then beetles on the side. I don't want to eat crickets on Super Bowl Sunday. That, to me, that is ridiculous. What are the things that we can do to combat this globalist crackdown on food? What are the things that we can do to change this, to come back to the way it used to be, to do things in real time to inspire people to grow themselves?
Yes, well, I think that we have to realize that education has changed for young people. It's one of the things we're looking at. And young people like my generation, the baby boomers generation, we had relatives who still lived on the farm. And I know in my own case, I spent every weekend and summers on my grandparents' farms. And I got a really different kind of education from what I got, you know, in school, you know, in the city. And it's very important. The organic research farms that Organic Consumers Association runs in northern Minnesota and Mexico, or they're like many around the world, they're teaching farms. You know, we're designed to bring city people and young people especially to come and have hands-on experience in how you grow vegetables, herbs, you know, how do you make maple syrup, or how do you harvest wild rice? You know, how do you take care of animals in a way that is, you know, it's fun, it's good for the animals. And, you know, so we've got to turn around our education again to include, you know, growing food, nutrition. It's like home economics when I was in school was a class only the girls took, but you learn some really important stuff. Like cooking and canning, that nowadays young people are in the dark about. And, you know, I have a 24-year-old son, and he's telling me that a lot of his friends now, they can barely afford to buy groceries, and they don't know how to cook. So they got to learn something that they should have learned long ago. So we all need to go back to grandma's culinary school and learn a few things in the kitchen. And what you'll find is that you can afford to buy the highest quality organic food to supplement what you can grow yourself, much better than the most expensive restaurant out there for a fraction of the cost. And we got to get back to this. Americans, for example, we only spend about 11% of our household income on food. And, you know, back in the early 60s, the average family was spending 29% of the average income. They weren't complaining about the high cost of food. We are now. It's because the high cost of living for everything else has become impossible.
Dramatically, yeah.
And middle class people. So we can cut food costs and get healthier by cooking at home. And don't shortcut your health by skimping on food while you're spending, you know, large amounts on the Netflix or your smartphone, or, you know, letting politicians rob you for taking your taxes and, you know, building bombs and subsidizing billionaires instead of doing what government's supposed to do, which is help everyday people survive with dignity in this life.
I think that's a great point. You are what you eat. And if you allow yourself to eat crap, that's how you're going to perform. You're not going to perform at your best self. You're not going to be your best self. You're not going to be the most positive person you can be if you don't eat the most positive things. I think that's a general, that's like an obvious thing. I want to talk about, as a farmer yourself, and you know, especially coming out of this time during COVID, during all these lockdowns, what to you is the most immediate threat? So the threat closest to you that these globalists are basically offering right now, that are posing to you, this threat that they are providing to you as a result of their ideology. In what ways are they directly threatening farmers right now?
They're threatening farmers by not only continuing business as usual to subsidize monopoly farms and fake food and synthetic, highly processed food, but they're trying to blame farmers, conventional farmers, who are typically the victims of this system, for being the cause of this system, like in the Netherlands. Yeah, I don't think it's the best way to raise animals in confinement and feed them, a diet of corn and soybeans. But if that's the only way you can be a farmer in Netherlands, and that's actually subsidized by the government, that's what people have done. So the point is not to blame farmers for our problems, because they are forced into using things like chemical fertilizer instead of, what our grandparents and farmers did for 8,000 years, which is to use animal manure and green matter for compost. It's like, let's all work together to create the kind of food system that we all want. And you don't create that by putting farmers and ranchers out of business. You do that by creating a situation where they're rewarded for doing things the right way, raising animals the right way, avoiding things that they don't want their family to get cancer. They don't want their families to to be obese, And so let's help all of us, farmers and consumers, move in the direction that we know we want to go in. And we'll find it's actually more efficient and economical. And the bottom line comes down to, are we going to have participatory democracy in rural areas and urban areas? Or are we going to have a form of authoritarianism where the global elite tell us it's all green, it's all just, it's all equitable, it's all healthy, and they know better than we do? We know what to do if we will sit down with our neighbors and our friends and our contacts, and figure out what we want and figure out how to get there. And we don't need corrupt politicians and out of control technology maniacs telling us what to do. And we nearly slipped into a global type of fascism, where our governments, whether we're talking about Canada or the U.S. or Australia or New Zealand, more closely resemble communist China than they did what Thomas Jefferson and others were talking about a couple of hundred years ago.
Well, I think that's a great point. I think right now we're facing a food crisis throughout the world. The world is facing a man-made food catastrophe. It's reaching crisis levels. Current policies in many parts of the world are placing a priority on climate change for realizing a Green New Deal, like that zero net carbon emissions by 2050. Meanwhile, such policies will contribute to children dying from severe malnutrition. Broken food systems will result in the shortages of food and water. Stress and anxiety and fear and dangerous chemical exposures are all going to rise as a result. This seems to me like it's an attack on humanity. It's an attack on not only the way that we used to do it, but any hope of doing it that way in the future, crippling humans' ability to ever recover from this by destroying the soil, like we see what Justin Trudeau is doing right now with his fertilizer ban in Canada, destroying the health of the soil, all in the name of climate change. What do you think, and farmers are being blamed for climate change. It's like to the World Economic Forum and these globalists, farmers are the main culprits of climate change. What do you think about that?
Well, as a farmer, no one wants to see unpredictable weather and more severe droughts, unpredictable rainfall. It's very, very difficult, especially like in Mexico, our research farm. We try to operate without a well. We capture water. You know, we depend on capturing rainfall off the mountains. You know, why have we done this until now while we're drilling a well?
Yeah.
Now, but why have we done this? Because 86% of the farmers in Mexico don't have a well, and they're never going to get a well. And so if we're going to show methods that work, traditional in a modern garb methods that work, we were trying to do it in a way that was like the way they have to farm. So no one wants the weather to get worse. No one wants it to become harder and harder to grow your corn, to have enough feed for the animals. Right. But what we have to realize is that these globalists are using the rhetoric of justice and climate stability and, you know, rural development. They're using the rhetoric of terms that sound good on the surface, but they have nothing to do with what their actual plans are.